Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, we start as we frequently do, almost always, with our WFPL News Roundtable and a look back at the developments around the metro and elsewhere. And joining us are Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. We've got the whole family here. Welcome back, everyone.
Thanks for coming. We're all back together.
Yes, we welcome your participation as well. 502-814-TALK is our phone number, 502-814-8255, or call us toll-free. 1-877-814-8255. You can also email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet, if you like, at WFPL News, or reach us through our Facebook account. Gabe Bullard, let's start with you and Philip. The mayor's office announced this week, Gabe, that it is conducting a sweeping review of overtime policies. What brought this on?
Yeah, well, a lot of cities, Louisville included, have gone through budget cuts. Louisville has left a lot of positions vacant, a lot of jobs haven't been filled, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are a lot of departments that are understaffed, and these workers are doing more with less. And that's led to a lot of overtime expenses. The mayor saw that what seems to be some exorbitant overtime spending, and he's noticed the possibility for abuse in this system. There were hundreds of individuals, about 10% of the city's workforce total, where each worker was earning $15,000 to $500,000 a year per worker. That's doubling the salary for some of these employees. So the mayor's office is going to start looking into this to find out if they need to hire more employees or what exactly they need to do to reduce some of these overtime costs.
Is this creating any tension among the workforce?
Yeah, I talked with the president of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. They handle a lot of the various jobs around Louisville, a lot of these metro government jobs. And they say, really, they have no choice but to do this work that they're assigned to do. They put some of the blame on non-union managers. They say these managers order the work, they approve the overtime. And also, this is putting the unions in a little bit of an odd situation. They can have more help if they would want more workers to be hired, which the president of AFSCME does. They would have more workers, and it would be an easier job or less work, less extra work for all the employees there, a more average workload. However, that would also end up cutting pay for some of these employees that have come to rely a little bit on overtime, maybe as a spouse loses a job, or they've gotten so accustomed to earning overtime that their standard of living has changed.
Philip Bailey, you've been talking to some Metro Council members about this. What's their reaction?
Well, Councilman Jerry Miller, Republican freshman, his opinion basically is that the administration knew about this problem over the summer, that during the budget hearings, this question came up about overtime pay. It's been something that's actually been a longstanding issue going all the way back to former Mayor Jerry Abramson. But for Councilman Miller, he sees this as something where maybe too much emphasis is being put on the workers, and the question really needs to be put to the managers. Why are they making these decisions? But as the city faces, and I believe the overtime bill thus far for 2011 is $21.8 million thus far, Councilman Miller and other members of the council, including Democrat Britt Ackerson, are raising a number of questions about why they can't get that information during the budget hearings accurately reported. And also the fact that they feel that the administration sort of drug its feet on this. Chris Pointer, the spokesman for Mayor Fisher, says that they knew about this over the summer. They just kept it under the radar, and they're just now revealing this information to the public.
Yeah, and we talked with Chris Pointer. Here's a clip of that interview with him.
This is a new issue to this administration, but I think you can talk to past administrations, and this has been an issue in the city for many years. It's just become a bigger issue now because of the financial situation that the city's in. You know, in the past, you could afford to pay overtime. We can't anymore.
Even if there was abuse?
You know, I don't know. You know, just like in a household, when money's tight, you begin to look at every expense, and you really need to scrutinize, you know, do you need that steak? Can you get by with chicken? And, you know, we have to look at this. You know, what are the core services for our city, and how can we continue to provide those services without major layoffs, without cuts in services? And overtime is one of the first places you look.
That was Mayor Spokesman Chris Pointer, who was a part of the previous administration.
Yeah, it should be noted he was a spokesman for former Mayor Jerry Abramson. It's interesting that, you know, Mr. Pointer talks about this issue of what are the core services? Because a lot of this overtime comes from the public safety agencies. Mm-hmm. There's that, and Councilman Miller brought up that question as well, which is the fact that you may be having people who work in public safety, whether police, fire, EMS, working and stretching themselves thin to have overtime. in that manner. And his option is something the mayor has already done with Public Works, which is just to hire more people. The mayor's office is saying that they're not really ready to say anything at this point whether they're going to do more cuts or hire more workers. But we are talking about our core services when we're talking about this overtime. We're talking about public safety employees, in some people's opinion, being stretched too thin, but who are working extra hours at the behest of their supervisors.
Speaking of public safety, Philip, Police Chief Robert White leaving town this week, headed to Denver, Colorado to be the chief there, and we now have an interim chief here in Louisville.
Yes, Isham Burks, who is the first African-American commissioner of the Kentucky State Police. He was named as the interim police chief earlier this week by Mayor Fisher. What's interesting about this choice is that I think the administration made a decision very obviously making a decision where they wanted someone who was going to be interim chief who was not interested in the position permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Bill Summers, the chief administrator, former deputy mayor for under Mary Abramson, who now works for Mayor Fisher, on public safety agencies. He said the reason they made that decision is that it removes the politics from the decision making. You don't have to worry about, is there interim chief making decisions to get the job? Is command staff maybe who wants someone else undermining that person because they don't want them to get the job? Isham Burks is not interested in this position at all permanently. He's just really just a holdover, someone who's just going to make sure the trains are running on time. And you see now the process beginning, the fact that we still don't have any applicants who've turned in anything, according to Summers. And that's simply because people want to get this thing right. I mean, there's some essay questions involved here. This is not an easy process involved in. It does seem that the administration is leaning more towards picking someone internally within the department, not going outside, although they're not against candidates from the outside coming in. But it seems that's where they're leaning towards. And I think that you see whoever succeeds outgoing, or former police chief Robert White, that person will mainly, I think, be interested in not only maintaining his relationships, communications with the community at large, probably improving some of those in relationships with the rank and file, which Chief White regretted in our interview with him earlier this week.
Burke's former state police commissioner, secretary of the state justice cabinet. What's been the reaction among the rank and file cops to this appointment?
Well, those that I've talked to, they have generally good opinions of Mr. Burks. There is this feeling that he's maybe more of an academic or an administrator. He is he currently serves as a professor at JCTC, Jefferson County Technical Community College. So there is this feeling that he's more of an administrator, hasn't really been a beat cop and knows some of those things, but generally positive views about him. He really won't have to worry and deal with that much. The mayor hopes to make a decision on a permanent chief in April. That'll be before Derby. So there's really not I believe he may have to deal with Thunder over Louisville, but for the most part, Isham Burks is not going to have to deal with any sort of controversial steps. Now, anything could happen between now and then. Let me make sure that's pretty well known. Anything mm-hmm. could happen regarding police, good or bad. So at this point, it seems like a very safe decision and by the administration to really remove the politics that you see in other cities. Sometimes mm-hmm. interim chief is selected, that person wants to be the permanent chief, but not in this situation.
And finally, some public forums have been, I think there have been two public forums held on what people and their expectations about the search, right?
Yeah, there have been two public forums that have happened. I know that some more have been scheduled, maybe even some more that have gone on. You see more and more people wanting to chime in with their thoughts on who the next chief should be. Like I said, this is probably the most important decision, one of the more important decisions that Mayor Fisher will make. The relationship between the mayor and the chief is a symbiotic one. Next to the mayor himself, the chief of police is probably the most public figure we have in metro government. So this will say a lot not only about the direction of the department, but a lot about Mayor Fisher and his decision-making. It will be very, I think, even more scrutinized than the replacement, picking a replacement for Louisville Metro Animal Services. And in that aspect, you'll see this decision scrutinized back and forth. But ultimately, it's going to be Mayor Fisher's decision.
This is State of the News on WFPL. It's our Friday News Roundup, and we welcome your participation. If you want to chime in on some of the topics we're discussing, 502-814-TALK. 502-814-8255, or join us toll-free at 1-877-814-8255. Erica Peterson, let's turn to you and talk about the return of Don Blankenship. That name came up this week. What's going on there?
Yeah, Don Blankenship is back, maybe, apparently, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what happened was ABC News, I believe, was the first to report that Don Blankenship basically filed papers to incorporate a new coal company in Kentucky, and he filed those in January. And since then, there's been no activity. There's no record that he has actually applied for a license or a permit in the state, but the intention seems to be to start a new company.
For those who don't know, Don Blankenship was the, and correct me if I'm wrong here, the leader president of the Massey Coal Company, right?
He was. He was in that position for about 10 years as the CEO and chairman of the board. And he was with Massey for a number of years before that. And the reason that people are very excited, and I mean excited, worked up, not excited, looking forward to it, at this news that he might be returning to coal mining is that he's kind of been a controversial figure. When he was in charge of Massey, the company had was known as an unsafe place to work. Its mines had a number of safety problems. He was at the helm when the Upper Big Branch explosion happened last year in West Virginia, there was a fire at another mine in West Virginia that killed two miners. The Martin County coal slurry spill here in Kentucky, that was a Massey mine. So there were a number of problems that kind of plagued the company during his reign.
So is there any evidence at this point that he's going to be doing some mining, or his company will be doing any mining in Kentucky?
Well, the thing is, he could. He left Massey about a year ago, and he had quite a generous exit package. And one of the things included in that package was a two-year non-compete clause. And Massey was then sold to Alpha Natural Resources. So he isn't allowed to compete with Alpha for another year at this point. But he can be involved in a coal company that mines less than, 5 million tons of coal. So, I mean, that would leave the door open for him to start his own smaller coal company. And at this point, there's nothing really standing in his way.
Speaking of Massey and the Upper Big Branch explosion, the MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, finished its investigation into that explosion this week, and what were its findings?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot new. They did a briefing in June where they laid out what they thought caused the explosion, and there wasn't anything, you know, breathtakingly different in this final report. Basically, what they say caused the explosion was a whole series of safety lapses. They blame it on Massey's culture, a culture that kind of prided production over safety concerns. And what they think caused the actual explosion was a whole chain of events, and any one of them shouldn't have happened. They say methane leaked in at the bottom of the mine. The methane detector was turned off, so it didn't sound any kind of alarm. The methane was ignited by a spark from worn-out teeth on the continuous miner machine. The teeth shouldn't have been worn out. They hit the rock. The fire wasn't put out by water sprayers because several of the sprayers were missing. And then the mine erupted into a huge explosion because the fire reacted with the coal dust, which was in unsafe quantities in the mine, should have been kept down by rock dust. So there was a whole series of problems that really shouldn't have happened. And MSHA investigators, Mine Safety and Health Administration investigators, are pointing to just a total disregard for safety in these mines.
And there was a huge fine levied in this instance, right?
Yeah, there was. It was joint. The U.S. attorney in West Virginia announced this settlement. It was about $209 million. And that is a record for this kind of penalty. And it includes compensation for the families of the victims. It also includes about $10 million for fines at Upper Big Branch for things that contributed to the explosion.
So was this the end of it? Is there anything next coming up?
No, and I think what everyone is waiting for at this point is to see if any Massey officials, including Mr. Blankenship, are criminally prosecuted for it. It's something, the last deal the attorney reached in West Virginia, a different U.S. attorney, was for the Aracoma coal fire, which killed two people. And that deal included basically a provision saying they couldn't go after any officials from the company and prosecute them. This one doesn't include that. It releases Alpha Natural Resources from any liability, but they can still go after individuals from Massey.
All right. Thanks, Erica. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. I want to go back to the city overtime probe and review that Mayor Greg Fisher ordered this week, because we have a caller who wants to talk about it. This is William, who I understand is a Metro employee. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to offer something about the overtime, or the way it's looked at. I haven't heard anybody talk about some of the budgeted overtime that the state pays the city to maintain traffic signals and things like that around town. It's actually better for the taxpayer, because that money's budgeted and it's going to go somewhere. So to go to an outfit like Louisville Metro that's already set up to handle that kind of thing, the traffic signal repairs and installations are done a lot more efficiently and quicker than if a contractor would have done it.
All right, William. Well, thanks for your call. Guys, does this involve budgeted overtime, or is this something that's above and beyond that?
Well, some departments do have budgeted overtime, and some departments even have scheduled overtime. Firefighters, for instance, if they work an overnight shift, are going to get some overtime hours for that. And that's something that the mayor's office is aware of and knows about going into this. One thing, as far as budgeted overtime goes, I talked with Councilwoman Butler, who's the head of the budget committee, who had said it won't be so easy as to just cut overtime or cap overtime without taking a careful consideration of what causes overtime. She used the example of saying public works employees who may have to clear roads in a snowstorm, something like that, emergencies that come up that may require workers to work overtime. So that's one thing that they're going to have to be a little bit more careful around.
And when you think about it, I mean, there are some departments in which scheduled overtime or budget overtime makes sense. For example, Thunder Over Louisville and Derby, for instance, for the police department and other emergency services. But what council Republicans and some council Democrats point out, though, is that that still doesn't explain the high and staggering bill that we have at this point, and the fact that some people who are making their annual salaries $44,000, they're earning $55,000 in overtime, literally doubling their salary. So for some people, that even the schedule or budget overtime, or what the caller was talking about as far as what the state provides, doesn't explain a system in which some people are receiving an exorbitant amount of money from this compensation process. That's why Councilman Brent Ackerson has called for the Government Accountability Committee to look into this. But it seems that Councilwoman Tina Warpew, who chairs that committee, says that this shouldn't go on at the council level until the mayor's review is finished. But I think you see more and more council members from both parties will begin to chime in on this, because the worry is, as we reported earlier this year, Mayor Fisher is concerned about the next budget he's going to have to do, which is supposed to be the one that's going to be really, really bad. And I think you see council members sort of trying to at least carve out space where they have differentiated themselves between the mayor on this overtime issue, saying that instead of making cuts, continued cuts to services, or laying off employees or furloughing employees or not filling positions, we need to hire employees to get this overtime bill under control.
All right, again, William, thanks for your call. We're going to go back or go now. We haven't gotten to you yet, Devin Katayama, is finally getting to you. We haven't talked about Occupy Louisville for a while. Of course, this is the folks who are working in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street folks, and have quite a representation here in Louisville. Some members spoke to the Metro Council this week.
Yeah, this was something that they have been planning for some time. A couple weeks ago, organizer Pam Newman, who seems to be a lead in a lot of the things that's going on with the Occupy movement here in Louisville, she told me that they were planning something. She didn't tell me at the time what it was, but some kind of surprise or something having to do with Metro Council. She said that it was going to be within the legal parameters at the time. And what they did was they spoke at Metro Council's full council meeting last night. They went over a ton of issues. Each person that got up and spoke, and there might have been about eight of them, they each had a different issue. So some talked about the housing market, or some talked about big banks or pollution issues out on Cane Run Road. And this is all stuff that they've been discussing in their own general assembly meetings that they have. So I think what this really shows is the first formal requests to local government at the local level that Occupy movement in here in Louisville has made.
Now, this group also got a visit from Chief White, who we talked about earlier, who's leaving town to go to Denver, seeking some advice.
Yeah, Newman told me that they were contacted a couple weeks ago by White to get advice on the Occupy movement and what maybe to expect in Denver. Now, the two movements are very different.
Yeah.
In the letter that they wrote to Chief White, they even mentioned how the Occupy Louisville movement has had a good relationship with police. In Denver, that's not so much the case. They've made some headlines recently, most recently about some communication records that were released by the police department showing name-calling, essentially, of the Occupy demonstrators. Also, a judge denied a restraining order that they tried to get against PD for accusing, essentially, police of mishandling or kind of being hostile during the process of removing them from their location. What they did with the letter is they contacted, Occupy Louisville contacted Denver to ask them what they wanted out of Chief White. And they basically responded and said that they would like Chief White to come by one of their meetings. But they did request that he be in civilian clothes. They wanted him to be just like a member of anybody else who's going to be in the movement. And they also asked that he consider the city's policies and consider any abuse or any kind of actions on anybody in restraints as excessive force. So this is stuff that you know that they've been saying out in the public, and they're just reiterating it. But I think it's a smart move by Chief White to kind of find out what is going to be accepted when he becomes the new chief over there in Denver, and what he's going to, how he's going to integrate into the community.
We've seen some reports from around the country of clashes between police and Occupy protesters or demonstrators, and also concerns about hygiene and the keeping these camps clean and the disease breaking out and all this other stuff. But it looks like it's well organized here in Louisville. I can't think of the site where they are now.
It's Founders Square. I've been down there several times. They do keep their site clean. Depending on when you go down there, you might see anywhere from a few people to 20, depending on what they're doing. But yeah, they're still there. And even in the letter, obviously all the Occupy movements are trying to stay as strong as possible. But the first thing that they recommended or requested is that they said they weren't going anywhere, that they're going to be sticking around.
Quite a tense city down there. And some of these folks have been accused of not being very well organized, but it looks like they are here at Louisville.
Yeah, and I think with the actions of Metro Council last night, it shows some sort of organization, some sort of formal requests at the government level.
All right, we have a few minutes left in our first segment. I'm going to go back to Gabe Bullard. Word out this week, Gabe, that Joe Reagan, the leader of GLI, may be moving on to St. Louis.
Yeah, and Philip, you feel free to chime in on this one as well. Joe Reagan, he's been head of GLI for a number of years. Since merger,
since
right?
Since 2005.
Since 2005, okay. So he had led GLI for these last 6 years, and he is being lobbied for this top spot in St. Louis. This has been an interesting thing. There were reports that he was a finalist for this job, I guess a month and a half ago even, that had surfaced, and there was a denial at that point. He said he wasn't really considering it, wasn't so interested. Now he's saying it was a combination of him being sought out for this job and also him applying for this job, and it is something that he's open to.
Go ahead.
And for as far as GLI is concerned, I mean, it has the dual role of not only being the city's, you know, chief economic development organization, but also the one that was to expand, attract and bring businesses. People will probably note that since the mayoral campaign, GLI has been under scrutiny, particularly since reports have come out about what has been called our lost decade here in the city of Louisville. And since that, between 2000 and 2010, we essentially didn't move anywhere as far as job creation. We remained pretty much stagnant, and that started actually before the national recession. So I think you'll see a lot of attention around this issue of, is Reagan leaving GLI? Who would be his replacement? But also, even if he ends up staying here, the questions around what will the city do as far as GLI is concerned, the city's Chamber of Commerce, and will it put any more benchmarks or goals on it? The fact that it gets $1 million from the city budget anyway does mean that it's somewhat under the city's purview. What I think is also interesting is the fact that many people have begun to point out that during this economic recession that has hit Louisville pretty hard, that Mr. Reagan has never taken, at least not to my knowledge, a pay cut. And even though he receives a pretty hefty salary, I'm not really sure exactly what it is. It's right around over like $350,000, I believe. But there's more and more scrutiny of GLI. But at the same time, credit has been given to the organization for the recent announcement with the Ford Motor Company. So there you see some, in some ways, some successes. At the same time, a lot of criticism still added.
And among some of that scrutiny, the Metro Council in its last budget process had decided to withhold half their money, even until further review could be done. Margaret Handmaker, Mayor Fisher had appointed Margaret Handmaker to do a review of the city's economic development, a sweeping review. That's due sometime before she leaves to go work on BEAM, the Louisville-Lexington partnership that's been talked about. And another interesting void that might be left if Joe Reagan leaves is his role on the Bridges Authority to build these two new bridges and rework Spaghetti Junction. Anyone who's gone to one of these Bridges Authority meetings has likely seen this sort of pre-meeting press conference that happens with some of the members of the authority speaking about the project, speaking about what they want to do. And in several of those, at least that I've covered, Joe Reagan has come out and been a big cheerleader on the project, talking about economic development, one of the more forward faces on this project to be promoting it. So if he's leaving, that would leave an interesting gap in the support for the Ohio River Bridges project and require a new appointment from the mayor to the authority.
And Philip, before we run out of time on another topic, going back to Metro Council, Bob Henderson, from a council member from the South End, may not seek re-election next year.
Yeah, this had been, you know, a rumor in City Hall for a couple of months. Councilman Bob Henderson, who is an original member of the Metro Council and been on it since 2002, he may not seek re-election next year. When I talked to him, he seemed to give both answers. at the same time, if that's possible. He indicated that he will make a decision the day before the filing deadline in January. He also indicated that if a successor, someone he approved of and saw had the same set level of energy and vision that he had for the district, District 14, which is in the furthest south end district there is, then he would not seek re-election. When I then asked him, well, has that person already gotten in the race and do you see someone? He admitted that, yes, there is an individual who is in that race who is filed to run for next year's seat that he feels has the interest, and that would be a Democrat, Earl Yoakum. He has an opponent, obviously another Democrat, Joel Romines, who told me, Mr. Romines told me that, you know, people go around the city acknowledge the fact that Henderson introduces Yoakum as his successor. Mm-hmm. I asked Councilman Henderson about that. He says that he has introduced Mr. Yoakum around town and to the constituents. Mr. Yoakum says that, Councilman Henderson does introduce him as a candidate. So it's this weird thing where a potential challenger and the incumbent seem to be very close friends and pals and sort of be palling around in the district together, even though both of them admit that the incumbent may decide to stay in the race. They have to run against each other. So it's no official announcement has been made yet. Councilman Henderson is in his early 70s, so it's not really clear what his decision will be. The reason this is important is because the 14th District is considered a swing district. It's one that Mayor Greg Fisher lost to Hal Heiner last year. It's one that Congressman John Yarmuth lost also. It's one that I believe President Obama, according to some election reports that I've seen, lost to John McCain in 2008. So the district, while it is a conservative Democrat in that seat, is one that Republicans could certainly pick up and one that they would like to pick up, considering that the Democrats control the council by a 17-9 margin.
All right, we will see what happens. Thanks to our WFPL news team and our Metro Roundup. We're going to be bringing Devin Katayama back a little bit later to talk about the Clark County School Board's decision not to renew the contract of Stephen Dashner. But thanks you all. Thanks to
Thank you.
You all.
Thank
for
you.
Joining
Thank
us.
You.
And it's time for a break. When we come back, the federal prohibition on blood donations from gay men, should it be lifted? Laura Unger of the Courier-Journal has been writing about it, and she's here today to talk about it. It's coming up next. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the holiday season is typically a time when blood donations run critically low sometimes, and some say one way to alleviate that problem is to lift the federal policy that prohibits most gay men from donating blood. The Courier-Journal's Laura Unger has been writing about the policy and joins us now. Welcome back, Laura. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
I was quite surprised, and I would think many others would be as well, to learn that the FDA has cast kind of a wide net when it comes to prohibiting gay men from donating blood. What exactly is the policy?
The policy is that men who have had sex with another man even once since 1977 is prohibited from giving blood because of the threat of AIDS, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
And I guess this policy put in place in the midst of the AIDS epidemic back in the 80s?
Yes, it was. But actually, last year, in 2010, they reevaluated the policy and decided to stand behind it. So it remains.
The concern being that HIV can be transmitted through blood transfusions. We remember the story of Ryan White up in Indiana, the young man who died of AIDS-related illness.
Yeah.
Other countries have lifted similar bans, right?
Yes. The United Kingdom lifted its ban this year. So that really brought this into the news again, and a lot of folks kind of found out about it for the first time. In fact, a lot of people don't know that the U.S. has this ban.
So some groups are saying, you know, we've gotten to the point here where this is not an abundance of caution. This is turning into discrimination.
A lot of folks do say that. And in fact, how I found out about it was I got contacted by some folks who actually had been turned away, wanted to give blood, and they certainly felt that they were being discriminated against.
So AIDS testing, I would assume, has become a lot more sophisticated over the years.
Yeah, and I talked to scientists who and doctors who mentioned that they didn't think that you need this lifetime ban anymore. There certainly is some consensus among some scientists that you might need a year-long waiting period for folks, or some say even less. Some say by 3 to 6 months, someone should be able to be diagnosed very definitively with HIV, given today's technology. So they say we need to, as a country, reduce this period.
How likely is it now for that one would get HIV from a blood transfusion?
It's very unlikely, according to a lot of the folks I spoke with. In fact, at the WINGS clinic at the University of Louisville, about a dozen of their caseload of patients got it that way, and all of them, it was decades ago. So we're talking about a small portion of the population.
Is anyone suggesting a modified policy that doesn't pay back to 1977?
Yeah, the Red Cross, as well as a couple of other blood-related organizations, are calling for a year-long waiting period versus the lifetime ban.
You know, it seems that we're always doing so. The Red Cross is reaching out to us to get the word out that blood supplies are critically low, and I would assume this would help alleviate that somewhat.
Certainly, folks have said that. The gay men who I spoke with for my story said, you know, they want to give. They believe they could really help in this time of shortage. And if the policy were lifted, they and many others could donate, and they can't now. So.
Any chance of the FDA revisiting the policy anytime soon?
Well, the FDA says that they really won't revisit the policy until they have assurance that their blood supply will remain as safe as it is today. They say the U.S. blood supply is very safe now, and they want to assure that that continues.
And you say that you were contacted by someone who tried to give blood. Were they surprised, shocked to learn of this policy?
Yes. The man I spoke with in his 20s, he had no idea that this existed. And he said he posted it on Facebook and got a lot of responses from other gay men who said they had no idea either. So and when I talked to gay activist organizations, they mentioned that's how they find out about it, or that's how they hear about the complaints a lot of times, because people will try to give blood, are turned away, and then that's how they realize this exists.
And you did your reporting on that this week. Was that appeared in the paper this week?
It was in Sunday's paper.
We still get it online.
Yeah.
All right. The Courier-Journal's Laura Unger. Thanks again for joining us, Laura.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. We turn our attention now to some developments out of southern Indiana. We're going to start with the Greater Clark County Schools, the school board voting this week not to renew the contract of Superintendent Stephen Dashner. Joining us to talk about it is Shay Van Hoy, editor of the News and Tribune. Shay, welcome back.
Hi, Rick.
And Devin Katayama has returned. He covers education issues for WFPL. Hi, Devin.
Good to be back.
Well, was this vote a big surprise, Shay?
Yeah, Devin and I were just talking about that before we walked in here, and it was. We were all expecting, I think all the media was expecting, the vote to come December 20th at the last school board meeting end of the year. They were required to let Dashner know before the end of the year if his contract would be allowed to expire, which will be at the end of June. But I think they had a rally the night before at Kai's in Jeffersonville, which had a good turnout. Current Mayor Galligan and some other folks, former board members that had recruited him basically to come down, showed up. And then, intense media coverage. I mean, all the TV stations have been there. You guys, us, mm-hmm. the CJ, and pretty much been on everyone's radar. And I think partially because Dashner spent so many years at JCPS, and it's kind of, a big figure around here before he returned after being in Chicago for a few years. So I think all of that led to the vote coming 2 weeks before expected, that they just the school board didn't want two more weeks of that attention. Is I think what happened.
And that's something that actually surprised me when I heard that. I spoke with Christina Gilkey, who's the board president, and she did mention how the media coverage drew a lot of attention to it, and they just didn't want to have to think about that with everything else that they had for the rest of the year. But I thought it was an interesting decision because of the support that he's been seeing with the rally, with the test scores and everything like that. I mean, even the Maple Elementary principal, I think, came out earlier this week at the board meeting and spoke in favor of Dashner. And Maple Elementary was on the chopping block for getting cut. It wasn't, but it had the possibility of being closed. So I think that really surprised me earlier this week.
Yeah, the fact that also at the board meeting, I think it was 20 or 21 speakers signed up to speak in favor of keeping Stephen Dashner, and no one spoke in favor of letting him go. Now, our reporter Matt, who was at the meeting, said that there were obviously people in attendance who weren't cheering and clapping when the supporters of Dashner spoke, and so there was obviously people that were behind the board in their decision. The big talk was about his salary, and $225,000 a year. At the first year of that, they'd gotten some private donations to supplement that. But whatever wasn't raised, and in the two subsequent years, the school board was responsible for it to come out of the general fund. But the thing is, to me, is I think that money played some part of it. But a couple of the school board members that are now school board members, in a way, ran on the fact that they thought it was kind of a sham and the means that Dashner was brought in. So I don't think it was all about the money. That's my personal opinion, that I think it was it's time to get rid of the superintendent.
Right. And it's really hard to get a read on exactly how they feel. I mean, they list several different things. In fact, we have a clip I'm going to play of Christina Gilkey, again, the board president. She mentioned to me that it was a lack of a strategic plan.
We've asked for a strategic plan ever since I've been on the board. We've never been able to get one. There's really not been any excitement on the part of the administration to develop that plan. And the reason that's so important is because if we all work together on developing a plan, that means we all work together on the direction we want to move in. And if we all agree on the direction we want to move in, then that relieves a lot of these 4-3, 5-2, 6-1 votes. Doesn't mean we won't disagree ever. It would be a lot less because we're all agreeing that the decisions we're making are part of the plan.
Now, you can also argue that the idea and the plan would be to increase student success, which he's done. So again, it's just you see how hard it is to get a good read on the reasons other than salary, because obviously salary was number one.
One person we haven't heard much of from publicly is Stephen Dashner. Has he said much about this? Has he said anything at all?
He talked to us briefly the story before the rally, kind of after the first stories had come out about the fact that the board members had said that it was unlikely that he would be retained at that position for that salary. And then there was executive sessions, which are negotiations which aren't open to the media or the public. And Stephen Dashner afterward told us that basically he had not been offered to stay as superintendent for a lower salary. He said that had never been offered to him. The school board didn't really say much about that, but he's saying that option was never presented and was a little bit going against what the school board members, some of the school board members had said.
I'm wondering, he went away, he was with JCPS, led that for 14 years, went to suburban Chicago for a couple of years. He likes it here in this area and came back. And not that he's too old to do any of these jobs, but I wondered at this point in his life whether he would want to go somewhere else or would settle for perhaps another position in the greater Clark system.
Yeah, that's what I think Devin was talking about. Hadn't got a lot of information out of him in terms of his plans. It seems like he is open to staying in another position, and it seems like the school board, at least they've been saying that's a possibility. I don't think he's going to work for peanuts, even if it's just a pride factor. And so you're looking at, if you cut a salary in half, it's still $100,000, and then you have to hire a superintendent. So you're right back where you started in terms of salary. Now, I know that some of the school board have talked about cutting other administrative costs, other positions. He's brought in a few people that worked with him at JCPS and from elsewhere too, which in a small community sometimes that just rubs people the wrong way. I don't know if you've heard that, where it's always brought in too many people from JCPS, and that's the people he's comfortable with and he'd worked with. So
yeah, I mean, it seemed like when I was speaking with Ms. Gilkey that it was going to be up to Dashner to come to them with a proposal of what he might like to do with the district, which I also thought is interesting. They're giving him that much leeway with this position, but they really, want to have the final say over this. And Ms. Gilkey was telling me that his new salary would probably be around $130,000, depending on what it was. I asked her how much they would be willing to spend. That's what she said.
All right, we'll move on to some other topics before we run out of time in Southern Indiana. Devin Katayama, thanks for sticking around. Talk about Superintendent Stephen Dashner. Shay, a few other things you've been covering. We understand that there's an investigation into some possible missing funds in the Floyd County Highway Department.
Yeah, we'd written about this a couple of times over the past few months. Basically, the Floyd County Commissioners had said that they were investigating the department, and Ron Quackenbush, the former department superintendent, soon after retired, which was November 1st when he retired. And we were basically not given much information from commissioners, as they said they were waiting on the investigation. And that came back Tuesday in the form of a state audit. The Indiana State Board of Accounts is basically the agency charged with looking into financial reports from, you know, a city council, a city school board, that sort of thing. And they found that at least some funds were maybe not where they should be or misappropriated. $11,000 in receipts were not accounted for. And they claim, the State Board of Accounts claims, that Mr. Quackenbush had created a separate private account at a bank, separate from the highway department's funds, and had deposited $5,000 or $6,000 into there over the span of a few years.
And according to one accusation, I think I read in your report that some employees said that he was buying candy and snacks and stuff with the department money and then reselling them.
Yeah, that was my favorite part of the report, actually. Where you read through those and they're pretty dry, and then you get something like that you can kind of laugh about around the newsroom. But yeah, apparently had been purchasing and upselling. It's kind of, maybe it's like one of those fundraisers when you're kids and you sell those god awful candy bars for $1 or whatever.
In this case, highly illegal. But he's maintained his innocence, I think, through his attorney, right?
Yeah, his attorney was saying that basically that he might have not have been, I think her words were, he might not have be the best bookkeeper, but that nothing illegal had taken place.
Never was any good at math. Yeah. I've heard that excuse, but innocent until proven guilty. Let's move on to some post-election shuffling going on. The Clarksville police chief apparently on his way out.
Yeah, Dwight Engel, who has been chief for about 20 years in Clarksville, has been notified by some incoming council members that they're going to go in a different direction. And he talked to us. He's always always been a really good source for us as far as being open, kind of a lightning rod figure in Clarksville. If you live there, follow Clarksville politics at all. But he's kind of said that's fine. He's going to go back and be a detective and do that job. But it's kind of a police chief that's chief for 20 years when a city council or a mayor has a depending on what size city or what type of government they have, is, you know, can change every 4 years. I mean, in the 6 years I've been in southern Indiana, we've seen police chiefs change in New Albany and Jeff, and he's been there for 20 years. But I think that reflects on the change that happened on the Clarksville Council. It's been pretty much the same people for about that same amount of time as Dwight's been the chief, and now we've got some new folks on the council, and they're kind of wanting to just, make a fresh start, I think is what they're saying.
Got about a minute or so left. In Jeffersonville, the mayor-elect Mike Moore making some appointments, some familiar names in that bunch.
Yeah, top of the list would be Rob Ways, who was the mayor before the current mayor, Tom Galligan, who Mike beat in the last election, is going to head the Economic Development Department. He had also ran in the primary against Tom Galligan, lost. And the other big change is the switch up in the legal philosophy of the city. Mr. Moore will be hiring two attorneys to have an in-house legal department, which Mayor Galligan has not had in the past 4 years. Kind of used a variety of attorneys for different types of uses, but not had an in-house legal department. And so that's the big change there, where basically there'll be people in City Hall, 40 hours a week working as attorneys. And then I guess the third kind of switch, it wasn't a surprise, but the animal shelter, which has kind of been under fire the last few years, will be getting a new director in the form of the consultant who came in the last few months to basically point out to the shelter leaders what changes should be made, and she's going to be retained full time.
Very quickly, I know you're an IU fan. UK coming to town tomorrow. A prediction?
Yeah, it'll be a UK IU UK filled house, both sides of my house tomorrow. It's going to be closer, but UK's so talented. I hope IU wins, but I got probably UK by, I'll say, 11.
IU on its way back, so it should be fun.
Next year.
That's right. Shea Van Hoy, the News and Tribune of Southern Indiana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
From Southern Indiana, we continue north to our nation's capital, where the Courier-Journal's James Carroll has been keeping an eye on Congress and the White House. Welcome back, Jim.
Well, thanks, and actually I'm even a little farther north than that today. I'm in New York City.
You got out of town, didn't you?
Yeah. You know, take a break every once in a while. Take a little breather.
This is a good time of year to be up there.
It is. It's all decorated, and New York looks, it can't look any more charming than it does at Christmas time. It really is great to be here at this time of year.
Well, President Obama says no one's going anywhere until Congress does the job to extend the payroll tax cuts and long-term jobless benefits. What do you see playing out this over the next couple of weeks?
I hope Congress has a very large repertoire of holiday songs, Christmas carols, Hanukkah songs, because they may be singing them together. You know, it kind of reminds you a little bit of watching to switch analogies and metaphors. It sort of reminds you of watching a Major League Baseball game and looking at a 200 hitter. You know, Congress does a lot of whiffing before it finally gets the ball out of the infield. And eventually, I am sure this tax cut is going to pass, the payroll tax extension. Mm-hmm. But getting there is going to be painful to watch, as is almost everything that Congress comes near these days.
And the Republicans are trying to, or some Republicans are trying to tie this oil pipeline to the measure.
Yeah, that, you know, and that's a non-starter for the administration. They want to go slow on this. You know, there are a lot of environmental groups are saying that the current route of the pipeline presents some environmental hazards, and so that's a, you know, it's kind of I don't want to call it a poison pill exactly. It's but it might as well. It sort of acts that way. It's not something that is going to be acceptable to most Democrats, and so they're going to have to negotiate that back out of the bill, and then we see what comes back into the bill. I mean, the whole question of this is, you know, how large is this? Is the extension just going to be a pure extension? Is it going to be a little larger, which the president would like? Is it going to be paid for, which the Republicans want to pay for with government, basically a freeze on government salaries and some cuts in government in the government workforce? Democrats want to increase the tax on the wealthiest Americans to help pay for it. They're not any closer yet.
In the meantime, some spending bills are still unresolved, right?
Yeah, remember that? The federal fiscal year started October 1.
Yeah.
And so far, by my count, I believe three of the bills got through in one package. And now the rest of the spending bills are being worked on, and they're looking at another deadline 1 week from today. The government is operating basically under a stopgap spending measure, which they call a continuing resolution, which has become the most common animal on Capitol Hill besides the mice. And anyway, that continuing resolution expires next Friday, which means if another continuing resolution or a final spending bill for the whole government to continue for the rest of the year, and the rest of the fiscal year, which takes to next September. If that isn't passed, we'd be talking shutdown again.
Mm.
So they have a very real deadline they are facing on that.
Well, speaking of shutdown, that harkens back to 1994. It's a nice segue to the Republican presidential race of this year.
Took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. That's a great segue.
Here comes Newt Gingrich surging ahead in the polls. What's going on there?
Who would have thought? Who would have thought? Somebody told me just the other day, they said, you know, it looked like he completely imploded, collapsed, and disappeared just last summer, and here he is. He's back. You know, at the moment, you have to say it's, again, the not Romney movement has picked a new front runner. But, you know, whether this is going to be sustainable is hard to tell, as everybody knows. Newt Gingrich, of course, has a lot of experience in Washington, both in government and in his post-government career, with a lot of clients, many of whom are close to K Street and places like that, you know, the lobbying crowd. Critics would say that he has so much baggage that his campaign would really need two planes, you know, one for him and one to carry all his personal baggage.
When do we get to the point where some of these other folks start, you know, dropping out of the race? Are we there yet?
I think right now, you know, I've watched this. I've had the privilege of covering a few campaigns in the past, the pattern usually is that even the people who are only getting, you know, slight smudges on the polling numbers, you know, the 1 and 2 percenters and the 6 and 7 and 8 percenters are all, they just hold on by their fingernails, at least to Iowa, and see what happens in Iowa. And it's only one more week until New Hampshire. After that, the problem, of course, is your money, if you had any money coming in, could dry up if you only end up being a smudge during the caucuses in Iowa. and people may drop out after Iowa. New Hampshire will probably be another winnowing process where you'll see quite a few more people drop out. Of course, a lot of people are saying that this race could end up being a two-person race between Gingrich and Romney all the way to the end. We shall see. I think it's still early to say that.
All right, we're out of time. Jim Carroll with the Courier-Journal's Washington Bureau. Jim, enjoy your time in New York, and happy holidays.
You too. You too.
Thank you. We're out of time. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, and Graham Shelby. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For more information about topics discussed on this program or to listen to it again, visit our website, WFPL.org. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.